Scotland Story from the author of Our Island Story, H.E. Marshall. Read by Vienna Vance. A History of Scotland for Boys and Girls, with pictures by J.R. Skelton, John Hassell, and J. Shaw Crompton. Chapter 1. The Story of Prince Gathelas. Once upon a time, there lived in Greece a king who had a son called Gathelas. Prince Gathelas was very handsome and brave, but he was wild, happy, and wicked, and he caused his father much sorrow and trouble. Over and over again, the king punished and imprisoned his son for his evil deeds. But in spite of all his father could do, Gathelas grew no better, but rather worse. At last, the king had no more patience with him and banished him from the land. When Gathelas knew that he was banished, he took a ship and, gathering as many of his friends as would come with him, he sailed away to a far country called Egypt. When they arrived in Egypt, Pharaoh, the ruler of the land, received them very kindly, for he was at that time fighting great battles, and he hoped that these happy young knights would help him against his enemies. This Gathelas and his friends did, and when Pharaoh had, with their aid, defeated his enemies, he rewarded them richly and gave them a city in which they could live together. Gathelas alone was not content with the rewards, for he had seen Pharaoh's beautiful daughter Scotta, and he longed to marry her. And as Pharaoh could refuse nothing to the gallant prince who had freed him from his enemies, he gave his consent, and Scotta and Gathelas were married. For many years Gathelas lived in Egypt, growing rich and great, and ruling over his people, who became more numerous as the years went by. And Gathelas loved his wife so much that he commanded that, in honor of her name, Scotta, all his people should be called Scots. But when Pharaoh began to be unkind to the children of Israel, and terrible plagues fell upon the land, Gathelas wished to live there no longer. So he gathered a great fleet of ships, and, with his wife and children, all his soldiers and servants, and a great company of people, he went on board and sailed far away across the sea in search of another country. After many storms and adventures, Gathelas and his company arrived, at last, on the shores of Spain. They had been tossed and buffeted about by winds and waves for many days. They had eaten all the food which they had brought with them, and they were nearly starving. So they were very glad to be safe on land once more. But the people of Spain were not glad to see these strangers, and they made ready to fight them. Gathelas, too, made ready to fight, and a fierce battle followed in which the Spaniards were beaten. But Gathelas and his Scots wished to live at peace with the people of the land, and, although neither could speak the language of the other, the Scots found means to take the Spaniards under stand that they did not wish to fight against them or to hurt them in any way. So the two nations became friends, and the Spaniards gave a part of their country to the Scots, where for many years they lived in peace. As the years went on, the Scots grew to be still richer and greater than they had been in Egypt, and Gathelas, who had been so wild and wicked when he was young, became a wise and good king. But when the Spaniards saw that the Scots had become a powerful nation, they were once more afraid of them, and they resolved to drive them out of the country. Then both the Scots and the Spaniards gathered their mighty men, and there was a great and terrible battle, with awful slaughter on both sides. But in the end, the Scots won the victory. Then once more peace was made, and the two nations agreed again to live side by side as friends. But when Gathelas saw how the Scots still went on growing richer and greater day by day, he feared that the Spaniards would again become angry and want to fight. So he began to think how this might be avoided. At last, hearing of the Green Island which lay on in the sea not far distant, he resolved to send some of his people there. Gathering a great number of ships, he filled them with soldiers, and, making his two sons, who were called Hyberus and Hymachus, captains, he sent them away to seek for the Green Island. For some days the ships sailed upon the sea, seeking the Green Island in vain, but at last they came to it and landed there. The Scots soon found out that there were very few people on the Green Island, and those who were there were gentle and kindly, and had no wish to fight. Hyberus and Hymachus, therefore, instead of fighting, tried to make friends with the people. This they easily did, for the inhabitants of the Green Island, seeing that the Scots meant them no harm, welcomed them gladly. So the Scots settled in the Green Island and taught the people many useful things. They showed them how to sow and plow and reap, how to build houses, how to spin, and, in many ways, how to live more comfortably. Then presently, in honor of Hyberus, who was their prince, they changed the name of the island to Hibernia. The island is still sometimes called by that name, although we generally call it Ireland. For many years the Scots lived in Hibernia. Gathelas died and Hyberus died, and after them ruled many kings. At last, when many hundreds of years had passed, a prince called Rothsay sailed over to the island which lay opposite Hibernia and took possession of them. The island upon which he first landed called Rothsay, and to this day there is a town on the island of Bute called by that name. The Scots, finding that these islands were fertile and good for breeding cattle, sailed over from Hibernia in greater numbers, bringing their wives and children with them. At last they filled out the little islands, and some of them landed in the north of the big island, which was then called Albion. After many, many years, the north part of Albion came to be called the land of Scots, or Scotland, just as the south part was called the land of Angles, or England. Some people think that this story of Prince Gathelis is a fairy tale. But this at least is true, that in far-off days when people spoke of Scotia they meant Ireland, and when they spoke of Scots they meant the people who lived in Ireland, and Scotland took its name from the people who came from Ireland and settled in Scotland. Chapter 2. A Fight with the Romans. When the Scots first came to Albion, they found it already peopled by the Britons and by another race called the Picts. It is not certain from where these Picts came, but they were a very wild and fierce people. It is supposed that they were called Picts from the Latin word pictus, which means painted, because they painted their bodies instead of wearing clothes. So there were three races living in Scotland, and these were divided into many tribes who often fought with each other. There were kings of Scots, kings of Picts, and kings of Britons, all ruling in Albion. Sometimes the kings and their peoples all fought against each other. Sometimes the Picts and the Scots joined together against the Britons. Those were fierce and wild times, and they were all fierce and wild peoples. They lived in caves or in holes dug in the ground and covered over with turf and with branches of trees. They wore few clothes except those made from the skins of animals, although the Scots knew how to weave and make cloth and bright-colored checks and stripes. A great part of the country was covered with forests. In these forests, wild beasts prowled about. Bears, wolves, wild boar, bison, and a kind of tiger were the fiercest, but there were also several kinds of deer, beavers, and many other animals which are no longer to be found in Scotland. The people hunted these animals and killed them for food and also for their skins, of which they made clothes. In hunting, they used bows and arrows. Bows and arrows were used too in war, as well as a long, blunt, heavy spear, and in hunting and fighting the men spent nearly all their time. Years went on. Many kings, good and bad, lived, ruled, and died, and at last a great and clever people called the Romans heard of the island of Britain and came sailing over the sea to conquer it. They landed first in the south of the island and tried to conquer the people there, and it was not until the year 80 AD, more than 100 years after the Romans first came to Britain, that a general called Agricola marched into Scotland against the Caledonians, as the Romans called all the tribes who lived in the north part of the island. Agricola took some of his soldiers into Scotland by land. Others sailed there in great galleys, as the Roman ships were called. The Caledonians did not fear the Roman soldiers. They had already fought against them many times, for they had often marched into the south of the island to help the Britons against the Romans. They were willing, says an old writer, to help towards the delivery of the land from the bondage of the Romans, whose nestling so near their noses they were loath to see or hear of. But if the Caledonians did not fear the soldiers, the great galleys of the Romans filled them with awe and dread. Never before had they seen so many nor such great ships. The very ocean is given over to our enemies, they said. How shall we save ourselves from these mighty conquerors who thus surround us on every side? But although the Caledonians were filled with dread, they fought bravely. As Agricola marched northward by the coast, his galleys followed him on the sea. Sometimes the galleys would come close to the shore, and the sailors would land and join the soldiers in the camp. There they would tell stories to each other of the battles and dangers, of the storms and adventures through which they had passed, each trying to make the others believe that their adventures had been the most exciting, their dangers the greatest. The Caledonians fought fiercely, but Agricola's soldiers were far better trained, and gradually he drove the islanders before him into the mountains beyond the rivers Firth and Clyde. There he built a line of forts. He knew that he had neither conquered nor subdued the fierce Caledonians. So he built this line of forts in order to cut them off from the south and shut them, as it were, into another island. Having built this line of forts, Agricola marched still farther north, but the Caledonians fought so fiercely that some of the Roman leaders begged Agricola to turn back. Agricola would not go back, but as the winter was near and the roads were so bad as to be almost impassable, he encamped and waited for the spring before fighting any more. The Caledonians spent the winter in making preparations for battle. All the various tribes forgot their quarrels and joined together under a leader called Galgacus. Sending their wives and children to a safe place, the men, young and old, from far and near, flocked to Galgacus, eager to fight for their country. When spring came and the roads were once more passable, the Romans left their camp and marched northward, seeking the Caledonians. They met, it is thought, somewhere upon the slopes of the Grampian Hills, but no one is sure of the exact spot. The Caledonians were little more than savages, yet they were ready to fight to the last for their country. They were almost naked. They wore no armor and carried only small shields. For weapons they had bows and arrows, blunt iron swords, and heavy spears. Those in the center of the army were mounted upon rough little horses, and there were two and there too were gathered the royal chariots with swords upon the wheels ready to dash among the enemy and cut them down. Against these savage warriors came the splendid soldiers of the Roman Empire, clad in glittering coats of mail, armed with swords and spears of sharpened steel, every man among them trained to obey, to fight, and to die. As the Caledonians stood ready for battle, Galgacus made a speech to them. "Fight today," he said, "for the liberty of Albion. We have never been slaves, and if we would not now become the slaves of these proud Romans, there is nothing left to us but to fight and die. We are at the farthest limits of land and liberty. There is no land behind us to which we may flee. There is nothing but the waves and rocks and the Romans and their ships. These plunderers of the world, having taken all the land, now claim the seas, so that even if we fly to the sea, there is no safety from them. They kill and slay, and take what is not theirs, and call it empire. They make a desert, and call it peace. Our children, our wives, and all who are dear to us are torn from us. Our lands and goods are destroyed. Let this day decide if such things we are to suffer forever, we are revenge instantly. March them to battle. Think of your children and of the freedom which was your father's, and win it again or die." When Galgacus had finished speaking, the Caledonians answered with great shouts and songs. Then with their chariots and horsemen they rushed upon the Romans. Fiercely the battle began, fiercely it raged. The Caledonians fought with splendid courage, but what could half-naked savages do against the steel-clad warriors of Rome? When night fell, 10,000 Caledonians lay dead upon the field. The Romans had won the victory. All through the night could be heard the desolate cries of sorrow and despair as women moved over the battlefield seeking their dead and helping the wounded. All through the night the sky was red with the light of fires, but in the morning the country far and near was empty and silent, and the villages were smoking ruins. Not a Caledonian was to be seen. They had burned their homes and fled away to hide among the mountains. Agricola, knowing that it would be useless to try to follow them through the dark forests and hills, turned and marched southward again beyond his line of forts. A few months later he was called back to Rome. Agricola had been 4 years in Scotland, and when he left it, the people were still unconquered. Chapter 3. The March of the Romans. Although the Caledonians had been defeated, they were not subdued, and they continued to fight so fiercely that the Romans gave up trying to keep the forts which Agricola had built. Later on, a Roman emperor called Hadrian came to Britain, and he built a wall from the Tyne to the Solway. This wall ran straight across the country from sea to sea, over hills and valleys, and it was so strong and so well built that, although hundreds of years have passed since then, it may still be seen to this day. But even this great wall did not keep back the Caledonians. They broke through it or sailed round the ends of it in their little boats made of wickerwork covered with the skins of animals. Some years later, another Roman emperor called Antonine came to Britain. He drove the Caledonians back again beyond Agricola's forts, and there he built a wall which is still called by his name. But the Caledonians broke through or climbed over this wall, too. The first man who leaped over the wall was called Graham, and the ruins of that part of the wall are called Graham's Dyke to this day. Dyke is a Scottish word for wall. Many years passed. The Romans called Britain a Roman province, but the wild people of the north not only remained unconquered, but they became ever more and more bold. They leaped over the wall more and more often, coming farther and farther south, fighting and plundering as they went. At last, an emperor called Severus, hearing of the deeds of the wild Caledonians, resolved to conquer them. This emperor was old and ill. He was so ill that he could not walk and had to be carried in a kind of bed called a litter. But he was full of courage and determination, and gathering a great army of soldiers, he invaded Scotland. Scotland at this time was covered in many parts with pathless forest, and even where there were roads, they were not fit for a great army, such as Severus now brought with him to pass over. So Severus, as he marched his army through Scotland, cut down trees, drained marshes, made roads, and built bridges. Slowly, but with fierce determination, led by a sick man he was carried about in a bed, the Romans marched through Scotland. From south to north they marched, yet they never fought a battle or came face to face with an enemy. The Caledonians followed their march, dashing out upon them unawares, swooping down upon and killing those who lagged behind or who strayed too far ahead. In this way, many were killed. Many, too, died of cold. Hunger and weariness, still on and on, over hill and valley, swept the mighty host to the very north of Scotland. There they turned and marched back again, and at last they reached the border and crossed beyond the wall, leaving 50,000 of their number dead in the hills and valleys of the north. No wonder that brave old Severus gave up the task as hopeless, and instead of trying to fight any more, he strengthened and repaired the wall which Hadrian had built so many years before. And so it went on year by year, the Caledonians always attacking, the Romans always trying to drive them back again. At last, nearly 500 years after they first came to Britain, the Romans went away altogether. When the Romans had gone, the Caledonians found the south of Britain more easy to attack than ever. For, as the Romans took away not only their own soldiers, but the best of the British, whom they had trained to fight, there was no one to guard the walls. So the Caledonians threw down and destroyed the wall between the Firth and the Clyde. They broke and ruined great parts of Hadrian's Wall, too, and overran the south of Britain as far as London. At last, the Britons were in such dread and fear of the Caledonians that they sent to their old enemies, the Romans, for help. But the Romans would not help them. The Britons then sent to the Saxons, and the Saxons came to their aid. When the king of the Picts heard that the Saxons had come to help the Britons, he sent to the king of the Scots, begging him to join in fighting them. So the Picts and the Scots joined together against the Britons and the Saxons. But when the Picts and Scots saw the great army of Britons and the strange, fierce Saxon warriors, some of them were afraid and stole away to hide themselves in the woods nearby. The two kings, when they heard of this, were very angry. They sent to seek these cowards, brought them back and hanged them, every one inside of the whole army, so that none might be tempted to follow their example. Then Dougal, the Scottish king, and Gallinus, the Pictish king, spoke to their people and encouraged them with brave words. When the battle began, arrows flew thick and fast, and it seemed as if neither side would give way. But when they came near to each other, the Picts and Scots charged so fiercely that the Britons fled before them. Then a fearful storm arose. The sky grew black with clouds, and the air dark with rain and hail, which dashed on friend and foe alike. In the darkness, the Picts and the Scots lost their rank and order, and, when the storm passed over, the Saxons and the Britons had won the battle. It was a sorrowful day for the Picts and the Scots. They fled away, leaving the Britons to rejoice over the thousands of their enemies who lay dead upon the field. But the Britons had no great cause for rejoicing, for the Saxons rid South Britain of the Picts and the Scots only to conquer it for themselves. And soon the Britons were glad to ask the Picts and Scots to help them to drive the Saxons out of their land. This they were never able to do, and the Saxons took all the south of Britain and made it their own. But Scotland they could never conquer. Chapter 4. The Story of St. Columba. In Ireland there lived a priest called Columba. He was very tall and strong and beautiful. He was the son of a king and might himself have been a king, but he did not care to sit upon a throne nor to wear a crown and royal robes. He did not long to fight and kill, as kings in these fierce days did. He was gentle and loving, and he longed rather to make people happy. So he was called Columba, which means a dove. When he was a little boy, Columba had heard the story of Christ, and he had become a Christian. When he grew up, he spent his time teaching other people to be Christian, too. For at that time, nearly all the people in the world were pagans. The Picts were pagan. Some of the Scots may have heard the story of Christ before they left Ireland, but if they had, they very soon forgot it amid the fierce wars and rough, wild life they led. Often, Columba turned his kind, gray eyes across the blue waters to the islands where his fellow countrymen had gone. He longed to sail over the sea to tell his story there and to teach the wild people of these islands to be kind and gentle. At last he had his wish. He found 12 friends who were willing to go with him, and together they sailed across the sea in a little boat. The boat, which was called the Dewey Red, was small and frail. It was made of wickerwork, covered with the skins of animals, and seemed hardly fit for so long a journey. But these 13 men were not afraid, and, taking with them bread and water and a little milk, enough to serve them for a few days, they set sail. They were dressed in long, white robes, their feet were bare except for sandals, and, although they were going among fierce, wild people, they took no weapons. God would guard them, they said. The sun shone brightly, and a soft wind blew as the Dewey Red slid out upon the waters. Columba sat at the stern, steering straight for Albion. But as the shores of Ireland faded in the distance, he looked back with tear-dimmed eyes. The rowers bent to the oars, and their eyes, too, were dim. These men loved their country dearly, but they were leaving it for love of others. At last they reached the islands of Albion, and they landed upon one of them. But looking back across the sea, they still faintly saw the shores of Ireland. "We must go further," they said. "If day by day we see our dear country in the distance, our hearts will forever return to it. Let us go where we cannot see it, so that we may be content to live among strangers, in a strange land." So once more Columba and his friends entered their boat. They sailed on till they came to an island, then called High, but which is now called Iona. The sun was setting as the frail little boat touched the rocky shore. Once more Columba looked back. The sea shone golden in the evening light, but across the sparkling waves no glimmer of the Irish shore was to be seen. Columba and his white-robed followers landed and, climbing to the highest point in the island, again turned their eyes westward. Still no faintest outline of the Irish shore was to be seen. They had found what they sought, and kneeling on the rocky shore, they gave God thanks who had brought them in safety over the sea. The dove and his message of peace had found a resting place. Upon the spot, a cairn or pile of stones was raised, which is called Cairn Coil Rí Éireann. That means the back turned upon Ireland. For 2 years, Columba remained in Iona. During that time, besides teaching the people, he and his men built houses to live in, and also a church. Most of the people who lived in Iona and the islands round were Scots. Many of them became Christian. Then Columba made up his mind to go to the Picts to teach them, too, about Christ. The king of the Picts lived then at Inverness, and from Iona to Inverness the journey was long and difficult. But Columba had no fear. Through the dark forest where wild animals roared and prowled by pathless mountainsides among fierce pagan people, he traveled on until he reached the palace of the king. But the king and his pagan priests had heard of the coming of Columba, and the gates of the palace were barred against him and guarded by warriors. Still, Columba had no fear. Right up to the gates he marched, and, raising his hand, he made the sign of the cross upon them. Immediately the bolts and bars flew back. Slowly and silently the great gates turned upon their hinges and opened wide of their own accord. At the sight, the guards fled in terror to tell the king who sat among his lords and priests. When the king heard the wonderful story, he rose up from his throne and cried out, "This is a holy man!" He hurried to meet Columba. Dressed in beautiful robes, Columba came slowly through the palace, followed by his white-clad monks. As soon as the king saw him, he knelt before him, praying for his blessing and protection. So the king became Columba's friend and helped him in every way. But not so the pagan priests. They hated Columba, they hated his teaching, and they did everything they could to keep him from speaking to the people. One day when Columba's followers were singing hymns, the pagan priest tried to stop them, lest the people should hear. But instead of being silent, Columba himself began to sing, and his voice was so wonderful that it was heard for miles and miles around. It was heard by the king in his palace and by the peasant in his hut. And yet, although it was heard so far away, it sounded sweet and low to those who were near. The sound struck terror to the hearts of the pagan priests, so that they too were silent and listened to the beautiful music. For 33 years, Columba lived among the people of Scotland. He traveled over all the land, telling to the fierce pagan the story of Christ. Many wonderful tales are told of Columba, and, although we cannot believe them all, they help us to know that in those far-off times there lived a man whose heart was large and tender, who loved the helpless and the ignorant, and who gave his life to bring them happiness. Besides preaching and teaching, Columba spent much of his time in writing. In those days, all books were written by hand, and Columba copied the Psalms and other parts of the Bible. One night as he worked, he grew very weary. He wrote the words, "They who seek the Lord shall want no manner of thing that is good." Then he said to those around him, "Here I must rest. Someone else must finish my work." Then, sitting upon the hard stones which served him for a bedded pillow, he spoke to his followers, "Dear children, this is what I command with my last words. Let peace and charity be among you always. If you do this, following the example of the saints, God who gives strength to the just will help you. And I who shall be near him will pray him to give you all that is needful to you in this life and to greatly reward you in the life that is to come." These were his last words. At midnight, Columba rose and, going into the dark church, knelt before the altar. His servant followed him, but in the darkness could not find him. So in distress he called out, "Where art thou, my father?" There was no answer. At last, groping about the church, the man came upon Columba lying upon the steps of the altar. He raised his head and rested it against his knees, calling aloud for help. Soon all the monks were roused and lights were brought. With cries and tears they crowded round their dying master. Columba could not speak, but he smiled upon them, and raising his hand seemed to bless them. Then, with a long sigh, he closed his eyes and was at rest forever.